Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Philosophy Exchange. Today, we're really excited in our artificial intelligence series to welcome John Zirilli. John, welcome. And for those who don't know, John is an author of A Citizen's Guide to Artificial Intelligence, along with some other co-authors. And he is currently a Leverhulme Trust Fellow at the University of Oxford in the law faculty. So we're delighted to have you here. And along with John, we also have Johanna Zerizoy, who is joining us from Edinburgh. And if you can't notice by the background noise, we are in Oxford, where John is based here today. So welcome, John.
I'm really excited for this first half-life hybrid podcast recording.
Yeah, me too. I've been looking forward to it for quite a few weeks, actually.
Right? Yeah, well... as have I, and I think it's really, an interesting occasion also to be speaking here in person. It's quite a contrast, I would say, from the awkward Zoom conference calls that have infiltrated our lives over the past 18 months.
Where exactly are you right now?
We're just outside the university administration building, but it's like central Oxford, I would say, right by... What's the name of the...
It's in Jericho.
Jericho, yeah.
That's really nice to have a visual image of where I can picture you right now.
So, shall we get started? I suppose we're just going to trade off questions here. And I think in reading your work, John, and for the listeners who don't know, you've done some work in explainable AI, which seems to be a really pressing topic for policymakers going forward. In simple terms, what is explainable AI?
Explainable AI, in simple terms, is the effort to make machine learning systems as understandable as possible to the people who will be affected by the decisions that are made by them. So you have these very complicated systems that, in large part, give you reliable answers in certain areas of life. And the problem is, though they achieve a certain accuracy, what they don't achieve is a transparency in the sense of what goes on under the hood. And so this is a problem that can be understood as both a technical problem. How do you literally, as a matter of software, how do you get some kind of cogent explanation from these systems? But it's also a philosophical problem, because we need to know what kind of explanation we should be aiming for, what matters to someone who is the subject of a decision. Not everything, obviously, will matter to someone who has been refused a loan, let's say. They don't necessarily want to know the specifics of the technical system, but they do want to know what the salient factors were that led to the decision one way or the other. So it's both a technical and a philosophical problem.
Mm-hmm. Or Johanna, you go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question, I think, about the goals as you see them. So you mentioned different reasons for creating AI. So, for example, we can have predicting, like a specific algorithm that helps us to predict certain data. Or we can also want an algorithm to be explain properly, or for the algorithm itself to explain. Which one do you think is more important, which of these goals, and which one should we aim to achieve more?
So if the question is, what should we prioritize between the accuracy of the system and its explainability, that is a difficult question, if not impossible, to answer in the abstract. It will depend on a case-by-case basis. So there are some contexts in which the reliability of the system, by which I just mean its accuracy, will be more important than understanding how it gets to its accurate responses. Then there will be other cases where it will not be enough to just have a system that gives accurate answers. We need to know how it gets at those answers. So I'll give you an example. So you could think of a situation in medical diagnostics, for example, where a system is provably far superior to any human diagnostician, and it could pick a disease It could, for example, tell you whether a tumor is malignant with a far greater reliability than a human oncologist, for example. In those situations, if we can't explain why it's picking so accurately, it's tracking so accurately the underlying pathology, it shouldn't matter as much as getting the reliable result. On the other hand, when you have a decision system that is used to make an assessment about whether someone is credit worthy, for example, if they're applying for a loan, or a system that is determining whether you are at risk of evading the jurisdiction, if you are, for example, given parole, or granted parole, or released on bail, in those situations, it's not enough to know that the system works very well, which would just mean the system tends to predict with a high accuracy if you are a credit risk or a recidivism risk. The reason why it doesn't, it's not adequate simply to know that it's tracking these phenomena accurately is because there's a sense in which knowing how it works is part of what gives us the confidence that it is working well. So with decisions that affect our rights and our interests, our legitimate expectations, it's an intrinsic feature of whether that system is doing the right thing, that it's doing it in the right way. So if it's accurate, but it's accurate in a way that's discriminatory, or it's accurate in a way that deprives you of natural justice, or what we call due process, procedural fairness, then it's not actually doing the right job. So that's an example of how explanation and accuracy pull in different directions.
Yeah, and Johanna, I think that you also had a question on this around, okay, what are the different types of machine learning kind of options or like?
Yeah, exactly. So I have a few questions. I'm gonna start with my other question, if that's okay, Carl. My other question was like, so now we talked about two different tasks, like accuracy and explanation. Where do you think like measurement comes into the conversation of AIs? Do you think AIs can also for some specific problems play the role of the measuring instrument itself? Basically, could an AI also be used as a measurement instrument?
Johanna, just so our listeners know, when you say a measurement instrument, can you give some examples of like other measurement examples?
Yeah. That's a good point. So I'm thinking about the simplest kinds of instrument that I'm thinking about would be like a thermometer, for example. Like a thermometer has a certain way that it works, and then we input some certain data, and then the thermometer gives us an output that we can make sense of. And we have AI systems, for example, you said we're using to give us information about the credit worthiness for a person. Could we not also say it's a form of like measuring the credit worthiness, or do you say that's completely a different sort of conversation here?
Well, the way that, just to take the example you've given, the way that a predictive system like a loan credit scoring system operates is inherently giving up a kind of metric. Everybody is who comes to be ranked by this system will receive some sort of scalar value. It'll be a discrete number, let's say from 1 to 10, just to make it simple. So in that sense, it is a metric. But I thought your question was actually asking about measuring the AI itself, the AI's performance, and whether we can use AI as a way of measuring the fidelity of the AI tool.
Yeah, I guess it would be like, can we be certain enough about the AI tool to say that it's predicting accurately, like so accurately that it would be comparable to, let's say, what the thermometer does, for example. Like we say, every time we use that algorithm, we know that it gives us this, the credit worthiness of that person accurately enough. Like, is that a goal for AI in general?
Yeah, so there is a goal in machine learning to essentially to vet the systems that are deployed. And there's a range of techniques, largely statistical techniques, that are traditional old-fashioned methods that are used to determine whether AI, machine learning systems, are performing as they should. So, I mean, just to go back to very, very basic sort of statistics 101, you might have heard of the area under the curve as a measurement. There are ways that you might have also heard of the confusion matrix, where you have the number of false positives and false negatives that you're willing to tolerate, and you can toggle between them, and you can adjust how many you want, how many false positives relative to how many false negatives and true positives and so forth. These are all old-fashioned techniques, but they're still incredibly useful when working out what we want a machine learning system to do. So if we're going to use a criminal recidivism risk assessment tool, for example, we might say that it's far more important that we minimize the number of the false positives than it is any other metric. And so if we state that this system will not be deployed unless it's achieving a certain number of unless it's achieving less than a certain number of false positives, and then you would either use or decline to use the system on the basis of that metric. I mean, that's a very simple old-fashioned statistical actuarial technique, but the same principle holds. As for whether we can automate that process itself, I'm not familiar with any systems that are capable of doing that, but I suppose, I mean, a lot of those techniques are just run on software programs anyway, so in that sense they are kind of automated.
Yeah, so I have a question. I think we've been talking about some of the applications of kind of artificial intelligence and also thinking on explainability, for example. These seem like really complicated issues for policymakers to diagnose and break down. I suppose, how might you imagine an AI so-called audit taking place in the future? And how might policymakers best kind of move towards such a procedure?
Can I clarify, are the auditors interested in how well the system explains itself, or are they interested in how well the system performs? What are they auditing, in your question?
Well, I think it would be useful actually to go into both categories, because this goes back to your earlier point when you were mentioning explainability even, where we have these two notions of explainability and where we have explainability for performative reasons, and we have explainability for kind of transparency of the system and
epistemic reasons.
Epistemic reasons,
you might say. Yeah. So, the question is, how would these auditors approach?
Specifically, how would a policymaker, I suppose, think on how an AI auditor would want to approach these different tasks? Again, from a high level.
I'm guessing that the policymaker themselves may not be so interested in the nitty-gritty of what it takes to audit these systems, because I think it would be someone with the technical skill that would go in and actually roll their sleeves up and ask the questions that need to be asked of the developers of these systems. But from a high-level policy point of view, I suppose the policymaker would be most interested in knowing that those very basic metrics, such as, for example, we've already mentioned them, rate of true positives, false positives, performance across demographics, whether performance deteriorates as soon as you use the tool on a different demographic, for example, it becomes suddenly you use it on an ethnic community and the performance degrades, for yes. example. These high-level features of the system's performance would, I think, be uppermost in the minds of a policymaker.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because one of the most high-profile AI kind of news stories has been kind of how prisoners are kind of selected to go to a prison using kind of automated technologies where certain populations are kind of chosen at a higher rate, a possibility of going to prison over other kind of racial communities.
Yeah. Yeah, the example you're thinking of is the Compass example.
Yes.
Which is basically the pin-up notorious scenario where you had a tool that was, according to some people's estimates, taking race into account when it determined somebody's eligibility for bail or parole, and even in sentencing. That's a technical debate to be had there, because there are different measures of fairness, and they can all be given a neat and tidy mathematical definition, but they seem to conflict. They're not compatible in real-world circumstances. So the company who produced Compass could say that it satisfied a certain definition, mathematical definition of fairness, what's called calibration, whereas those who were alleging that the tool was biased against African-Americans could also point to the fact that it failed to reach a standard of fairness, mathematical fairness, that they had in mind, which was different to the one that the company and the developers had in mind. So it's not easy to say whether a tool is biased or not if we go by these metrics, and we're going to make someone unhappy at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Can I ask you I guess a personal question, like what sort of machine learning techniques are you specifically most interested in, and how does the choice of these techniques then set up unique challenges for explainability?
The systems that I've been most preoccupied with are supervised learning systems, and of those,
as compared to unsupervised.
As compared to what are called unsupervised learning systems. I don't know how much detail we would need to go into.
Yeah, could you explain what would be a supervised learning system?
A supervised learning system is one where you have, for example, a task that you want the system to accomplish, and it basically boils down to some sort of prediction task or some sort of classification task. You want a system to tell you what the likelihood of something happening may be, or you want the system to tell you whether it's looking at an instance of type A versus an instance of type B. You want it to distinguish, for example, between cats and dogs or wolves and huskies. And what you do with supervised learning is you give the system, to make this very, very basic, you give the system lots of examples of, let's say we're talking about a classifier, lots of examples of dogs, and you tell the system through a process called labeling that this is a dog that it's seeing. And then you give it loads of examples of cats, and again, you label, you tell the system that these are cats, and you run this procedure over and over again. And by the end of the training, that's called the training phase, you can let that system loose on examples of dogs and cats that it's not seen before, and you sort of cross your fingers and hope that it tells you that it's looking at a dog when it's given a dog and looking at a cat when it's given a cat. So that's supervised learning, because all the examples of the things you want it to distinguish are given to the system and are explicitly told through labeling that these are what you want them to be seen as. Mm-hmm. That's different from unsupervised learning, where there is no such labeling going on. You just give the system a whole bunch of information, and you leave the system itself to find interesting patterns in the data without telling it what it's seeing.
Yeah, which is really interesting just as a background, because so many of the questions that are coming up around artificial intelligence in relation to policymakers, in relation to, you know, these questions about AI audits, for example, these questions relate to unsupervised learning, where there isn't necessarily an understanding of the epistemic kind of procedures of the systems themselves. And it seems to me, as say a layperson in this field, that this these areas can be understood clearly by policymakers.
Interestingly, most of the examples of systems that are used in, let's say, the public service or even in corporations are actually supervised systems. Unsupervised learning, I don't believe, has yet achieved anything like the prevalence of supervised learning in solving practical problems, but it does have application in some areas of commerce, such as customer segmentation. So if, for example, you don't know which products to market to a certain group of people, you might use unsupervised techniques to be told what correlates with what sorts of products correlate with what sorts of demographic factors, for example, without telling the system in advance, okay, this is, for example, a certain kind of shampoo, and this shampoo will be liked by a certain, let's say, adolescent, maybe a young a woman demographic. There's none of that. That's the supervised scenario, but you may not have that knowledge beforehand. So you would use unsupervised learning techniques to segment your customer base, to work out what sort of products to market to which sort of demographic.
So, and you said you're more interested in the supervised learning techniques.
I have interested only in the sense that that's what my work has been preoccupied with. And right. Because that is what that kind of machine learning is the one that has presented most of the ethical issues, legal and regulatory and ethical issues. As I say, unsupervised learning is not really widely used yet.
Right. Yeah.
The high profile case of the system that taught itself a deep mind to play Go, that's Alpha Zero. That was a case of unsupervised learning. So it was given a few rules and it was told to work out how to play Go at a standard that could thrash the leading Go player, world champion. But that's not really an ethical sort of quandary. It's not that's doesn't really pose any ethical problems. And while it foreseeably could, because it hasn't been applied yet in any domain of concern to human beings, it just hasn't presented as something worth looking into as a matter of urgency.
Yeah, I think as we come to the close of this conversation, there's one question that I would ask you, John, and that is if you could make one anticipatory change to the legal system as we adopt AI in our regular kind of day-to-day lives, what would that one change be?
I think I would like to see people paying Facebook and Google an annual fee to use their platforms and not to avail themselves of these platforms simply by allowing all their personal data to be mined. Yeah. I think Facebook and Google could make plenty of money just charging people for the service.
That's a fascinating idea. Yeah. And I think we would be having entirely different discussions on data privacy if people were more conscious of the fact that their data is being used in so many different ways.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah, and I guess it would also change the way that Facebook, or like Meta, is trying to make money, they wouldn't have to necessarily sell that much data in like in the background without having people knowing about it in the first place, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a question about consent as well. Like if you're willing for your data to be given away and you have to pay for that as well, then maybe the threshold is a little bit higher for people to join. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on to this podcast. I think you two are going to go on to a wine bar, so
yeah, that's right. We're going to enjoy ourselves peacefully here.
That's wonderful. I wish you a lovely time.
Let's emphasize peacefully.
Yeah. Sorry, what was that?
We're not going to do so in any sort of way that arouses hostility, violence among the local population.
Yeah, we are by some, I think it's called the Martyrs Memorial, which is a famous monument here in Oxford. We shall try not to be burned to the stake for our actions tonight.
That sounds very reasonable. So
we will be saying things that would have landed us at a stake a mere 3 or 4 centuries ago.
Wow. Sounds like stimulating conversation. Well, anyways, I want to thank you, John, for coming on to this podcast, and Johanna for joining us from Edinburgh. I think I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope to our listeners that you have as well.
Yes, I definitely have. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for setting this up. Have a good evening, you two.